Accession number 8171, reel 16.
Mr. Metalman, reel 16.
So we were now at the Dnieper, and I think we were holding the line until the first frost came. And then, whether we heard about it or whether we were pulled back, I just cannot remember for sure, but we were being pulled back because Russians had broken through. The Red Army had broken through, I think, at some other place, had come over the river, had taken Kiev, and for that reason we were forced to go back. At that time, sometimes it was funny, it was laughable. The officers overwhelmed us with medals. I think they realized that there was a danger of great disillusionment, and by giving us little bits of metal which we stuck to our tunics, Iron Cross and the Panzer Medal and all sorts of things. Oh, by the way, talking about medals, I received a medal once called Kampf dem Bolschewismus. At least that was a translation into German. It was a Romanian medal, and I received it from Marshal Antonescu in Simferopol, the capital of the Crimea. He didn't put it onto my tunic, but he put it onto the tunic of some officers, of German officers, and then we received it from his officers. But he walked in front and just nodded his head towards me. He was a fascist dictator of Romania, the great German ally. He was a little man and looked a funny man, really.
Why so funny?
Because a uniform on him was out of every measurement. He was too small for a uniform. He had high boots. The boots seemed to be too long for the length of his body. He was thin. He didn't look like a soldier, though he was a marshal. But, well, that's just a sideline. So I had quite a few medals, and sometimes I wondered whether it would have been a good thing if ever I would have been taken prisoner, that I should have so many medals. And then I found they were a nuisance. You got hooked up with them, and nobody saw. You couldn't show off, really, because all the others had them too. So you strutted around there with medals on your chest. So, like so many others, we just put them into our pockets and then wanted to take them out again when we come back to Germany and show off there.
Do you think that it did raise morale?
No, it didn't raise morale at all, because most of us, there were some who were very national, socialistically minded, I think. They had a belief in Hitler. But most of us, we had lost that belief, because we had been told so many times that victory is just around the corner, that all these little things, the little setbacks, they were called Stalingrad, Kursk, setbacks, I ask you.
Stalingrad?
Stalingrad and Kursk. Mm. Battles like of that kind, to call it setbacks. And the promises, they came again and again. A battle of that kind was lost, and we were being told, oh, everything will be all right. This was just some sort of a mistake, and some officer was blamed, I think. My commander once, my divisional commander or something, I think Hollett was his name. He was threatened with court-martial. I'm not sure about it anymore. And there was a kind of officer threat within the army that if Hollett would be court-martialed, they would do something or what, a kind of a beginning of a revolt. It wasn't like that, not a revolt like that. There was opposition amongst the officer corps, and it was being put to Hitler that it was like that. And Hitler, Hollett, I don't think, ever had a court-martial. But I'm not very sure about that. But there was definitely something about Hollett. I think he was a general. By now, of course, we were retreating and retreating again, and we were coming back towards the Romanian border. I remember an incident there. We took position near a river. I don't think I have mentioned it, an old woman with mines. Anyway.
No, we haven't recorded it.
No. Because panzers and other vehicles, they blew up. We had a pontoon bridge across the river, and it was steppe country. There was no road leading to it. The vehicles, like panzers and jeeps and marching soldiers, were like a funnel moving towards that river. And some of them blew up every day. A panzer ran over a mine or a jeep or a lorry and burned. The panzer lost its track. There was a village nearby, and we had the suspicion there's somebody who comes out at night and digs in a telamine, as we call it, a plate mine. It's like two large plates put together and cleverly dug in. If a lorry goes over there, it blows the lorry up. We put out special guards, but it was such a large area to cover. We were unlucky for quite a time. And then one day, one of us, who watched the village, which was just over a mile away further up the river, watched the village. He saw a figure moving out, and he followed that figure. He waited, I suppose, that no one else was involved, that it was only that one figure. And then he pounced, because we were being told to get the person alive, if possible. And he caught an old woman of between 60 and 70, a typical old peasant woman. She was small, she was bent, she was really a poor woman. She had some cord tied around her. And the mine was hanging down from it, and she also had a spade, so she was caught red-handed. There was absolutely no doubt about it. We were in tents by the river, and I remember I got up in the morning, and the first thing I saw, there were some willow trees. She was tied to a willow tree, and I didn't know anything what had happened, and I wondered, an old woman tied to a tree, what's going on here? And then one of the guards told me, an old woman tied to a tree, she is the one who has planted the mines. At least he caught her with this one. And I went over to her and I said something like, there they caught you. And she spit out and screwed up her face and turned her face from me as whether she didn't want to speak to me. At that time, I remember our commander, the battalion's commander, his name was Madsen. I don't know whether I've mentioned him before. He was about 50 years of age, and he was a decent man. He was a good man, as far as I judged then and as I feel now. But, of course, Madsen had his duty. There was a little kind of a shed, a log cabin, where our officers had maps, and it was a kind of a command post by the river. She was taken in there that morning, straight after I saw her, I think, and was being asked where she got the mines from. So I wasn't in there. I don't know exactly what they asked her. But she was not tortured. Madsen was in there, and with Madsen, nobody was being tortured. I heard some shouting going on, and they shouted at her to frighten her, I suppose. But later on, I was told she had given nothing away. I had asked her what her name was when she was sitting out there, and she said, Galina. And I said, and your other name? And she said, that's all you get from me. Galina, that's all. So she came out again, out of the hut. We were just sitting around there. There was no great Russian pressure at that time. We were there to protect the pontoon bridge, which was, the river wasn't very wide, maybe 100 yards. And the pontoon bridge was heavily used. We had flak against air assault. And I saw her coming out. She walked between two guards. It was ridiculous. Each of the guards was about almost twice the size of her, and she had bast shoes on. She hardly could keep up with them. She was in a poor state, but she was proud. and she was bent, and I remember she... it was difficult for her because she was bent. She wanted to throw her head back to show us how proud she was, how she detested us. And she somehow managed to do that. And some of us, we were joking about her because it was such a funny picture. The two guards, we were calling for the two guards, whatever the name were, and were laughing about them. And they felt embarrassed to have to walk with their rifles, as an old woman who couldn't run away because she couldn't even keep up with them. She was taken to the field kitchen, and I think she refused food, but she accepted drink. And in the meantime, somebody had nailed a beam on to the side of that log cabin, the gallows. And she came down again, and she watched it, how one of us had a rope and tied it around there and put a noose in there. She just stood there and looked at it. And I thought... that was courageous. There was real heroism, because she knew exactly what was going to happen to her. Then there were a couple of ammunition boxes were put up as a kind of a platform to stand on, and she was told then to get on there, and she was awkward. She couldn't get on there. She wanted to get on there, and she fell down once and hurt her legs, and she was rubbing her leg. And then she was helped on there. They lifted her onto it, more or less. And she was protesting. And there, too, the protest was not that she didn't want to go on there. She knew that she couldn't escape from there, from that. But that she had to be put on there. She wanted to get on there on her own. Anyway, they put her on there. And one of the guards, friend of mine, he wanted to put the noose around her neck, and she very contemptuously, she pushed the noose away, and then she kind of made her speech, and she said, you Nazi swines, you pest on this earth, long live the revolution, Lenin will live forever, something like that. I cannot recall the exact words, but when I wrote it down later on into captivity, I wrote it down like that, so that is the nearest to her words I can remember. And before that, that was, yes, when she came from the field kitchen, she asked one of the guards, could she have a last wish? And he said yes. And she said she wanted to go down to the river, and she said something that was her river, and she had lived there all her life. And he said yes. She walked on her own. The guard stood back, and we all sat there. And she kind of put her hands together as was in prayer. And her lips moved, and then she said something like, Do Svidaniya, and I think the name of the river was Mios, but I cannot be sure on that anymore. I think she said, Do Svidaniya, Mios, and then she turned around and said more or less, well, I'm ready, take me, boys, or something like that. Well, anyway, Madsen stood there when she was on the ammunition box, the noose was put round her head, and he kind of nodded to the guard as whether now get on with it. He got fed up with it all. And I saw him saluting. He put his hand to his field cap. And we just sat around. I sat there behind Madsen. And the guard just kicked the ammunition box away. And that was bad. Was that? She was dangling there. And then Madsen turned around and said to me and to two or three others, take her away and take her in. And, So I went up there, put the ammunition box back in order to get to the rope, and untied her on the top. And we took her down, and it shows me how hard I must have been. We just carried her away, and everyone was getting on with his business. And we went down to the river, halfway down to the river, where it was dry, and we dug a grave, not very deep, because we couldn't be bothered to dig a deep grave. I know it sounds all bad for myself, but these are the facts as they occurred, and I don't want to say any excuse on my behalf. We put her in. The rope was still around her neck. I remember I left the rope like that and laid it next to her. And I touched her. I looked whether she got a ring or anything, and she had absolutely nothing. And I thought about it. There must be some in the village, surely, who are waiting for her. And she was here all on her own and got hung, and there was none of her people around there. I felt in many ways it was real heroism. So we filled the grave in, and I wondered about this village, and said she must have relatives. Oh, she had said something when I asked her about Galina earlier on, when she was sitting by the tree. That was significant. She said to me, and I got three sons, and they are all soldiers. And she said it in such a way to me as whether to say, and they'll have you for that. She didn't say that, but she was very proud of that. So I don't know why I really did it, but there was some spark of humanity perhaps left in me. I put a stone on her grave, and I think I did it as an indication that the villagers later on should find her. I'm not sure about that anymore, but I think that's why I did it.
How long did she take to die?
Straight away. You break your neck, you know. You that's where you kick the ammunition box. You're not strangled. That is the worst thing, to get strangled. I understand that all those who had tried the putsch against Hitler, 20th of July 1944, Field Marshal Witzleben and others, that they were strangled by rope. No, we were humane, and I put that into quotation. We didn't strangle our victims. We kicked the platform away, which broke their neck. Instant death. Yes, so while we went towards the west, of course, again now, there were quite a few battles were still going on. What also happened, well, battles not so much. There were just, we were setting back and always trying to get away from it, but sometimes we had to make a stand in order to get the whole of our front back, I suppose. But then again, as an ordinary soldier, you never really know what on the whole front is going on. What also struck us for quite a time now, since that winter before that we had to fight partisan units now. Before that, it was only the Red Army, really, we had battled with, and partisans who were hidden somewhere in the woods and in the villages. Of course, we were totally unable to control the huge area we had occupied. They were more or less doing some blowing up of bridges and causing all sorts of nuisance, and maybe shooting somebody here and there, shooting from afar and running away. What now was happening, that there were real partisan units in civil uniform, in civics, not in uniform, and we found them sometimes when we were on the retreat, that there was a bridge or some important spot, or that we were going through between woods on either side or so, that we came under heavy fire and really had to fight them. That was something new, which we had not experienced in that way before.
Did you actually see any of the partisans?
Oh, yes, saw some of them, and you saw them jumping about, and then, of course, sometimes we beat them, sometimes we got away. When we beat them, nobody got away alive, not of the partisans. That was an order, everyone was shot, and we had a fury. We were furious, partly, I suppose, because of our own disillusionment. Now we wanted to go back to the West, we wanted to get out of everything, and we somehow recognized that the Red Army, yes, the Red Army had beaten us, and that we have to accept it, it's an honorable thing. But partisans, somehow our whole disillusionment and fury, we let it onto them if we caught them. None of them got out of it alive. We took no prisoners.
Did you actually have orders to take no prisoners?
Yes, yes. Partisans, we were being told that that is it. They come under no protection whatever. They are breaking every law. And we could deal with them as we liked. And I don't want to say too much, but I don't know of any partisan who got away alive. And that included women. There were a considerable number of women amongst them.
Would you have killed any yourself?
Not in a murderous way. Yes, shooting them. Shooting them when they came over, or so a machine gun or whatever one had, and they came up with hands up, that was it. They were called terrorists or whatever, criminals. And so I did not shoot or kill anyone personally as such, but after they had thrown away their weapons, which comes to the same thing, I suppose.
What kind of weapons would they have had?
Oh, of course, they had machine guns, and of course they had rifles. But towards the end, they had heavier weapons too. Mörsers, we called them, for instance. I don't know what are they being called. You shoot something like a grenade high up into the air and it falls straight down. They are ideal if somebody is in a trench, you want to get at him, or somebody behind a house or behind something.
A mortar?
Mortar, I think mortar is in British. We called them mortar. They had these, and they had also light artillery weapons, if I remember rightly. Light ones, which you could pull around without horses.
Were their weapons Russian or German?
No, mainly Russian. But, of course, they must have had some German weapons. You know, it's difficult to remember it exactly, but they must have had some German weapons, yes. But mainly Russian, because we noticed it at that time that our Air Force, our Luftwaffe, was in operative. We never saw any German planes. They had complete control in the sky, and they were more or less coming over when they wanted to, and some of the planes, well, you knew it, they had material for partisans, and they dropped it, and they had plenty of room to do that in, because we were now more or less on kind of roads back. We were not going back on the whole front anymore. We had collected, and we were just keeping in tight bunches. And in between, there was plenty of partisan area, and they were supplied by plane.
Did they ever stage any ambushes on you?
Oh, yes, 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 quite often. But we, on the whole, we were still fairly well armed. We were perhaps better armed than the partisans. And it was dangerous for them to do so, but they did it. They set up traps, and they were very courageous, very heroic in many ways to do that, because they must have known that we didn't let one of them go, didn't let any of them go. But they had machine guns set up somewhere, and for that reason, moving back, we used a Panzerspeewagen, how do you call them, small panzers, so not to give our marching units getting them into a trap.
Which unit were you in at this time?
Oh, there were no units. It was all Kampfgruppen. There were the units as we knew them in the beginning of the war, when we went into Russia, divisions, battalions, they more or less had disappeared. One didn't talk anymore of battalions. It was Kampfgruppen, and we were decimated in many ways, and the rests of one battalion and another, and there were Luftwaffe soldiers even in that area, more or less ground soldiers for the Luftwaffe. They belonged to our Kampfgruppen. And whenever we met another Kampfgruppe, often it was then decided whether the two Kampfgruppes would melt or whether we would go on our own. Some units, of course, came from the West, from Poland, and some of them, I think, even came from France. They arrived as units, but they were quickly torn to bits as well.
When the new recruits came, who hadn't had experience of the Eastern Front, did they seem to have a different attitude towards the veterans like yourself?
Well, at that time, I don't really know whether there were recruits coming. They were coming from some other parts, from France or so. They were not all recruits. But the experience I had earlier on, when we were smashed about, that we got recruits, they were, on the whole, they were rather frightened. And as human beings are, we were showing off. We were telling them about all sorts of battles, and I think them listening to it, they must have thought, crumbs, how do we ever get out of that? We put ourselves to them as real heroes. And they were rather meek, most of them. And whether we overdid it or so, I don't know, because continuously our situation got worse, and they had to be some sort of heroes in order to save their own lives. They quickly learned. So we moved back, and I remember we were now coming close to the Romanian border. Nobody knew exactly where we were. We had no maps. We had no nothing. We ordinary soldiers. And some of us even said we are already in Romania. And some said, no, we are still in Russia. Well, it's not really Russia. The Soviet Union. Ukraine is there. Then I remember, it must have been about that time, that Marshal Antonescu had fallen. And there was trouble with the Romanians. Now, the Romanians, of course, all the time, they were going back with us. And now there was trouble with them because they were even more disillusioned than we. And as they were coming now close to their own country, I suppose there was a real possibility of some sort of a revolt because obviously there was trouble in Romania. Antonescu had been pushed away, and we knew there was a fascist party, and there was some internal struggle going on. But I remember I was quite happy knowing now we were coming towards Romania, because all what I wanted was to get out of it. We knew the war was lost and that the Russians had beaten us fairly and squarely. Of course, we had plenty of trouble with sickness, diarrhea. I remember I had very bad bouts of diarrhea, which in winter is horrible. You have to sit down there with your trousers down, and it's well below freezing, and you can't get up. You know, when you get up and button everything up again within a few minutes, you have to sit down there again. It takes a lot out of you. And also, of course, we were suffering from lice, and any wound or so you had, it festered, because the lice, body lice, they were all over you. I was suffering badly from that, I remember. And also lice, you couldn't sleep at night. You were just lying somewhere fairly comfortable and got warm somehow, and you wanted to drop off, and then lice are starting to walk across your belly somehow, and you start to itch and to rub and to do, and they bite, of course. They bite in order to suck blood. So we had some powder, which they called Rusla, I remember, which was anti-lice powder, and we were being told to rub our bodies, to rub it on our bodies. But this Rusla, it was horrible. It smelled horrible. And somehow, I think they wanted to, the idea was to chase the lice away by the smell. But it chased us away. We smelled horribly, all of us. It was terrible. But we had to do something against the lice. So sometimes the joke was going that we didn't have any lies, the lies had us.